The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Thomas M. Harris presiding.
Good morning. This is case number 4-24-1022, People versus McKinney. Counsel, first may we have appearances for the appellant?
James Waller for the appellant.
And for the appellee?
David Mashin with Illinois Appellate Prosecutor for the state.
All right. Before we proceed to hearing argument on the case this morning, I'd like to address a couple of matters. First, I wish to note that this case had previously been set for oral argument for May the 6th at 1 o'clock. The court was ready to proceed. Mr. Waller was present. Mr. Manchin, you were not present. And before we begin, we're going to ask that you first explain the circumstances as to why you did not appear for argument on that date. There are a couple of other matters that I'd like for you to also address. One of which is there was a motion to reset oral argument that was filed by the appellant in this case. And based on my review of the record here, it doesn't appear that there was ever a response filed by the state to the motion. In the body of the motion, it states in paragraph 9 that a draft of the motion was forwarded to counsel for the state on May the 13th, but that the state had not responded to appellant's counsel's attempt to meet and confer regarding the substance of the motion. So question then to you would be, did you respond to counsel for appellant? And if not, why not? And then a third matter would pertain to the prayer for relief in the motion. Now, appellant does not affirmatively request that we find the state's that the state has forfeited its opportunity to present oral argument, but indicates it should be left to the discretion of the court. In your comments, you may wish to address that portion of the prayer for relief as well. So you may proceed, Mr. Manchin.
First, with regard to the May argument, I had a migraine headache that morning, and I laid down with my alarm on at 11 a.m. with the alarm set for 45 minutes. I woke up at 4 p.m. that day. I called the court and explained the circumstances the next day. That's why, and I apologize the court to that. It was just beyond my control. As far as the motions to reset, I just did not see that there was any reason to respond to it. I didn't see anything to object to, and I had not before it was filed. I had not seen anything as asking for whether I had any objections or anything like that. And when it was filed, I just did not see any need to respond to it. That's the only thing I have to say about that.
Let me ask you this before you get to the third item, which is whether or not the state should forfeit its right to present oral argument. And that is just simply, did you reach out to counsel for appellant after missing argument to explain the circumstances of your having missed oral argument?
No, I apologize for that. I did not. I reached out to the court to explain, and I was going to contact counsel, but then forgot, and then it got onto other matters and never got around to it. I apologize to counsel for that.
All right. As to wishing to present oral argument here today, if you wish to speak to that.
If oral arguments can be presented, I would like to respond. I have no, it was defendant's request for oral argument. And I requested it only in response to that. After the Supreme Court ruled on the armed habitual criminal charges, I really don't know whether what point will really be served by oral argument because it can be solved on the briefs, but I am able and willing to participate in an oral argument if the court deems that I should not participate. That's within your prerogative.
Okay, I'm going to ask if my colleagues have anything to add or to ask of you. But before I do that, I will just provide one editorial comment. And that is, in this situation, the one thing that I can see, which is a glaring omission, is I believe that you should have reached out to Mr. Waller following oral argument to explain your absence. I think that, as a professional courtesy, was warranted.
Yeah, I agree.
Justice Zinoff, Justice Leonard, do either of you have anything you wish to ask?
Yes, not really to ask, but to underscore, Justice Thomas, what you said. This is a very serious matter, and the court takes oral argument as well as appearances of counsel and missing an oral argument very seriously. But underscoring all of that is professionalism. And Mr. Manchin, it's my understanding you've practiced quite a long time. Professionalism should be ingrained at this point, and a simple phone call to co-counsel who waited an extra hour, took time out of his day away from other matters to abide by the request of the court. And quite frankly, for you to have said that you forgot is just incredulous to me, quite frankly. And
I
it's
did
other
not.
matters.
I
Excuse me,
okay.
sir, I'm speaking. And so it seems to me that this should have been top on your list to make a phone call to opposing counsel in this case to explain what had happened and to apologize to him. And certainly, under those circumstances, I would have thought a response to his request to meet and confer regarding his motion before presenting it to this court would have also been a top priority. So I just want you to understand that I underscore what Justice Harris told you and would expect that this would be part of how you practice law going forward.
All right, Justice Leonard.
I will echo the sentiments of my colleagues and simply add, I think at that point, for some reason, you did not see the request to confer on the motion. At a minimum, there should have been a response immediately filed to the motion because the motion in the prayer for relief is indicated, at least alludes to the request that perhaps the state should not be allowed to participate in oral argument. So I think professionalism is key. And I think Justice Zinoff and Justice Harris have outlined why that is so important. And so it is certainly disappointing to learn that even as we sit here on July 1st, when this matter was set back in May, there's been no contact with counsel regarding the failure to appear at oral argument.
Okay, I thank my colleagues then for their comments as well. Mr. Manchin, I'm going to trust that this is something that we will not see again, and I hope our comments have not fallen on deaf ears. At this time, we will proceed with argument of the motion that was filed by appellant, motion to reset oral argument, is simply going to be denied as moot. We have reset oral argument, and we are ready to proceed here this morning. So, Mr. Waller, are you ready to proceed with argument?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, you may.
So
Counsel, you're muted.
I apologize. Thank you. I want to also note I appreciate the apology from Mr. Manchin. So that is heard. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jim Waller. I'm with the Appellate Defender's Office. It's my pleasure to represent Troy McKinney before you here today. I appreciate the court's time this morning. I intend to use it to explain why Troy is entitled to a new trial. As the court's aware, as counsel's aware, the Supreme Court has decided People v. Wallace. That case adopted the state's interpretation of the armed habitual criminal statute. I accept that it generally forecloses our first argument. We ask that the argument be preserved, but I'm not going to dwell on it today. That leaves us with the problems of the trial itself, specifically the court's conduct and defense counsel's lack of response to that conduct, as well as other failures. The judge's comments in this case supplanted the jury's exclusive role. This case was always going to rise and fall on credibility and the precise timing of when Troy left the house and why. There were no fingerprints on the weapon, no unbiased witnesses, no conclusive evidence of ownership or possession of the weapon. The jurors had to decide whether to believe the state's theory, that Troy ran outside to move a gun from a vehicle because he heard Ms. Adams call the police, or the defense's theory, which maintained that the gun found outside the apartment was not Troy's and that he never even knew the police had been called. The court has already identified this as an important question in this case. In that delicate credibility context, a neutral referee is crucial. But the record shows here that Judge Lyons stepped out of his lane again and again, placing the full weight of the bench on the prosecution side of the scale. He misstated critical facts. Mid-trial, Judge Lyons informed the jury on his own initiative that Ms. Adams had testified that Troy, quote, went outside because I called the police, unquote. That statement never appeared in the evidence, ever. In this trial, that because meant everything. It turned an ambiguous exit, Troy stepping outside before officers arrived, into proof of consciousness of guilt. That ambiguity was the entirety of the evidence on that point until the court created the consciousness of guilt by making that up. Judge Lyons also added editorial asides that telegraphed a bias against the defense. When defense counsel is asking questions to clarify the order in which things happened, the judge announces in 305, "I think we know what happened here." Well, you may, but I got 12 other people who I need to talk to here, Your Honor. Those 9 words told the jury that the court had already made up its mind about who was telling the truth. But then Judge Lyons went on for the rest of 305 into 306, telling the jury what he thinks happened and what he believes people testified to. He totally glossed over details and timing that mattered, particularly in a domestic battery trial, saying that Ms. Adams somehow got butter on her somewhere along the way. Defense counsel was arguing that physical aggression by Adams precipitated the struggle. But the court, telling the jury that she got butter on her somewhere along the way in a passive voice, trivialized that argument and ignored the defense's theory that these things were caused by Adams's own aggression and actions. And then he just flat out demeaned the defense's theory. When counsel tried to suggest that Ms. Adams might be the aggressor, the judge scoffed, telling the jury that a contract case or civil court was the proper form for that argument. I presume the judge meant a tort case, but either way, it wasn't just a non sequitur. It told the jury that this perfectly legally appropriate defense had no place in the trial. All of these things reinforced a non-existent timeline. The court's running narrative enshrined the idea that the 911 call preceded Troy's departure and thus created that consciousness of guilt, even though the record never fixed that sequence as occurring. The court cut off defense counsel's attempts to clarify that sequence. Illinois law makes reversal mandatory when the judge's words imperil the jury's independence. In People v. Sprinkle, Supreme Court held the judge may not convey comment in a way, excuse me, that conveys to the jury an opinion as to the credibility of a witness. In People v. Kelly, the First District emphasized that even a taint on the verdict must be removed to protect and preserve the integrity of the process. The U.S. Supreme Court goes further still. In Toomey v. Ohio, that case teaches us that due process is offended not only by actual bias, but by the mere possibility of bias. Here, the bias is demonstrable, leading to a due process violation on the record. The state argues that the jurors were instructed to rely solely on the evidence. But as we point out in our brief, our Supreme Court has cautioned that jurors are ever watchful of the trial judge and noted that judges' slightest words may prove controlling, People v. Marino. A hostile attitude towards an accused is very apt to influence the jury in arriving at its verdict, which requires reversal under Kelly. Now, to affirm, the state must show beyond a reasonable doubt that their error had no effect on the verdict. In a case hinging on whether Troy knew the police were coming, the judge's statement creating that very knowledge out of nothing can't be harmless. It's something it's a burden the state just can't shoulder here.
Excuse me, Mr. Weller, I do have a question. In
Absolutely.
looking at all of this, don't we need to really look at the context and the circumstances that prompted the judge to make comments in the first place? And wasn't that during the course of cross-examination? And if we look at that, certainly we know that the judge has to rule on any objections, and also certainly has it's permissible for a judge to really circumscribe cross-examination to make sure it's not too repetitive, too lengthy, It's within the scope of what the question was. And so a trial judge does have the right to insert himself or herself under those circumstances. Isn't really that what we have here?
You're right, the judge has the ability to do that and the right to do that. That's not what occurred here. Most of these comments, not all of these comments, came in response to objections. One of them did, when counsel says, well, did the butter just walk off by itself or did the groceries walk off by themselves? State says, objection, argumentative. Instead of just saying what a reasonable judge would say, what a proper neutral arbiter would say, which is sustained or overruled, or let's hear some argument about it, the judge just restated what the judge believed the evidence to be. So the judge can do those things without inserting himself into the juror's role. Also, as far as circumscribing, because you're right, it is a claim of ours that the judge basically cut off defense cross-examination here. The judge can do that on a lengthy or repetitive cross-examination. We know that it's not lengthy because this is a very short case. We're almost through the trial and we're on page R306 here. We know that it was not repetitive, because many of these questions still remain unanswered. As this court found in the original appeal, these are important questions that were unanswered. So they couldn't have been repetitive if they were never addressed in the first place. And as far as clarifying the evidence, the way a court generally, the way a court properly clarifies the evidence is by asking follow-up questions after the questioning. I mean, that's how it's been in my 18 years of experience. The judge will say, you might have asked some questions, and may walk through a couple of questions. The judge doesn't clarify the evidence by telling the jury what the evidence is. That falls well outside of the definition of clarifying and well outside of what the court's allowed to do. So all of those things, and again, there are certain circumstances where we would give the court the benefit of the doubt. And we would say on a cold record, it's hard to say that this is telegraphed any real bias against the defense. Judge Lyons has lost the benefit of the doubt in this case. In this case, if nothing else, I generally cited to all of his comments and behavior during pretrial, during post-trial. Those are maybe more relevant on the first appeal, so I kind of summarized them here. But you did everything but beat your chest. I'll give you something to cry about. You want to go to jury trial? I'll take you to jury trial. Let's go tomorrow. While he didn't even have an attorney in the room. Like, there was bias against the defense throughout the whole trial, and that was clear, and there's no benefit of the doubt that it wasn't clear coming through on the record here. So because of the judge's behavior on its own, a new trial is required. Now, this court, excuse me, remanded the case back to determine why defense counsel did not object to these statements by the court. And what we got was an answer. Counsel's fear-based silence satisfies both prongs of Strickland. Now we know, because of the remand, counsel testified that he objected to the trial court's remarks, or excuse me, that he recognized the trial court's remarks, misstated the testimony, but he refrained from objecting because, and these are his words, quote, "it would not endear me to the court," unquote, "and it might," quote, "be problematic for my client," unquote, if he simply objects to testimony from the court that he knows is wrong. That admission, like I said, checks both boxes under Strickland. It's deficient performance because objecting to invented evidence is not a tactical nicety. It's defense counsel's sole job and description. Yet counsel chose personal rapport with the judge over his client's right to a fair trial. And we know it's prejudicial because the judge's remarks alone supplied the sole direct evidence of Troy's knowledge that a gun even existed, let alone that he knowingly possessed it and went out and moved it. Without an objection, the jury heard that uncorrected, and no curative instruction was given. So all we need to show is a reasonable probability, even less than 50%, that a different outcome may have occurred. Here, that's not very speculative. It seems overwhelming when there's no other evidence on this point. But the deficient conduct didn't end there. Counsel also testified that he never reviewed discovery with Troy after the state elevated the charge to a Class X. Behavior that the circuit court called stark and jumping off the page before ignoring on remand, said, I guess it's no big deal. He chose not to subpoena the 911 recording because, in some cases, there's prejudicial information on them. Strategy divorced from investigation is not strategy. Counsel had a duty to make a reasonable investigation or to make reasonable determinations that investigation wasn't necessary. Simply not subpoenaing that 911 call, which was in law enforcement's possession, was not reasonable. You cannot decide how to defend if you never learn what you're defending against. So counsel's candid testimony leaves us with a binary conclusion. Excuse me. One of these two things has to be true. Either his fear was well-founded and Judge Lyons would indeed punish objections, in which case the trial was tainted by judicial intimidation, requiring a new trial under argument two, or the fear was irrational and counsel's silence was objectively unreasonable under Strickland, requiring a new trial under argument three. Excuse me. Under either alternative, the Sixth Amendment was violated and the conviction can't stand. The American jury trial is built on two pillars: an impartial judge and zealous, unafraid advocacy. In Choi's case, both of those pillars cracked, one under the weight of the judge's own words and behavior, and the other under the weight of counsel's fear of that behavior. The Constitution does not permit a conviction erected on such a foundation to stand. When the judge demonstrates this kind of bias, intentionally or otherwise, and defense counsel feels too cowed, too intimidated to object, the case must be retried. So we ask this court to vacate, remand for a new trial. Thank you. If there are no other questions, I'll speak with you again shortly.
All right, thank you. You'll have time in rebuttal, Mr. Manchin.
May it please the court, counsel. In this case, the trial court's remarks could not have deprived the defendant of a fair trial. Defendant continually states that whether he knew the police were called before he left the house was key or central to the case. That is simply not true. The evidence showed that the defendant was standing by the car as the police arrived, and he's walking away from the car as the police arrive. If I recall correctly, the flashing lights were on the police cars on the shoulder cam, but at least the police were visible in the thing because you can see him walking away from where the gun is found on the police camera. He knew the police were there and had to get rid of it there, whether or not he knew beforehand that the police had been called. And as far as the prejudice to the, all the court's remarks went primarily regarding the circumstances of the domestic battery of which the defendant was convicted, was acquitted, excuse me. The acquittal shows that the jury was not being misled, was not being convinced that they could only or were only to required to consider one charge because they considered both. They were instructed as to both. They signed verdicts, different verdicts as to both. The court's remarks were proper within its scope to clarify evidence, to respond to objections, and it did not direct a verdict for the defendant or show the state an opinion as to anybody's credibility or this weight of the evidence or tell the jury what verdict they should enter. So I don't believe that the trial judge's remarks are sufficient in this case to require reversal. Regarding counsel's performance,
Counsel, if I may, Mr. Manchin,
yes.
there before you proceed. With regards, though, in particular, and I know you've addressed those in response to the objection, but when it comes to the issue where the court states he went outside because I called the police, when he's talking about Ms. Adams' testimony and he rephrases it in that way, would you not concede that that is inaccurate? He is not the trier of fact, and that is not what she testified to.
Her testimony was eventually he went outside. Yeah, he went out the door. Did he leave with anything? Because I called the police. That a reasonable interpretation of that is the defendant left because he went outside because I called the police. It's not that blatant or that much of a misstatement or a misinterpretation of that statement.
I
He
think it
went
could
out
be
the
an
door because I
inference.
called the police.
I think it could be an inference, but I think the point is it is he was not the trier, the trial judge was not the trier of fact. We had the jury. So while it's an inference, it is not a specific quote as to what she testified to. Would you agree with that statement?
It's not an exact quote, correct.
Okay. So even if we presume for the moment that that particular comment, and I'll say for the purposes of this hypothetical, only that comment is improper. Then, I guess specifically, would you address counsel's suggestion, though, that this particular piece of evidence would have changed the outcome, and specifically impacted the conviction if we find, under my hypothetical, that this is the only statement that was improper?
Well, the evidence regarding the gun charge was that the defendant was standing by the car, walked away quickly as the police arrived. The gun was found in the alley. It was in a gun case that was described by the girlfriend as being the defense gun case. Nobody leaves a gun laying in an alley unless you're dropping it to avoid the police. Given the timing of when the police arrived, the timing when the defendant walked away from the car, where the gun was found, the similarity between the case found and the gun case described by the witness, the conclusion that the defendant was possessed that gun was overwhelmingly, regardless of whether he knew. Not the 911 call was made beforehand because, again, the evidence showed that the defendant is walking away from the car as the police are arriving and as the police are walking towards that car. You see him on the shoulder cam walking away from the car where the gun was found, from the side of the car where the gun was found, walking in a rapid, what I would suggest would be a rapid pace. The conclusion that that is his gun is inescapable, regardless of whether he knew 911 was called before he left the building. And I don't think his knowledge of the 911 call can be called central or key or pivotal in any sort way or sort of form.
Thank you.
Okay. And with regard to counsel, the testimony at the this was a full Frankel hearing with a new attorney representing the defendant with testimony from both the defendant and trial counsel. So the standard is whether the decision made by the trial court below was manifestly erroneous. And the trial court found that the question, as far as both the failure to object and the lack of sharing discovery and the failure to subpoena were all did not establish ineffective assistance of counsel. And I believe that that decision is not manifestly erroneous. With regard to the failure to subpoena the 911 tape, counsel testified that he was familiar with its contents and was aware that it referred to a gun, and he did not subpoena the tape for presenting to the jury. Because he did not want the jury to hear that evidence of the witness on the phone referring to a gun because of the gun charge. He also testified that he didn't want the jury to hear the contents of the tape because he didn't want to hear the tone of voice or whatever. He just chose not to present the tape. Because of as a matter of strategy or tactics, we cannot establish prejudice from the failure to subpoena the tape because that tape has is no longer in existence. So any claim that there's something on the tape that would be helpful to defend it is pure speculation. This was the decision not to present the tape. And to a subpoena the tape was a matter of judgment or strategy, and defendant cannot establish prejudice. With regard to the discovery, counsel testified that he had defendant read this discovery prior to the first trial, that he went over he reviewed the case with the defendant before the second trial, but he did not have the defendant read discovery a second time for the second trial. That is not ineffective assistance. That is within judgment of counsel as to how do you share discovery. The new charge with the habitual criminal added nothing to the facts of the case or the underlying facts of the case. And the increase in the charge was also no surprise to the defendant because he had been told long before that if he didn't take the a plea agreement, the state was going to be bringing these greater charges. And as far as the new charges that a habitual criminal with the prior offenses, that requires no consultation with the defendant regarding discovery for presenting the trial because the prior convictions are within the defendant's own knowledge and would have no bearing on how the case is presented to the jury. Again, there is no showing of prejudice here. There's no showing how letting the defendant read the discovery for a second time would have made any difference as how the case was presented. So there's no ineffective assistance regarding the alleged failure to discuss share discovery because it was shared, and the co counsel testified, and the court accepted his testimony that he had reviewed the case before the start of the second the start of the new trial, and that he had not had provided the res discovery to the defendant again before the second trial. Because there was just nothing new that will require sharing the discovery at that point. Now, with regard to the court's remarks during trial, the trial court found that that was not ineffective assistance of counsel, that that was within the judgment of the of counsel not to object that I'm trying to find the exact wording that the court used. The court said on page 571 of the record, I come down to the side that it did not impact the case such that any effective assistance for challenging it was not or would not have changed the outcome of the case or arguments that would have been made. That is the trial court's ruling regarding the failure to object to the court's remarks, that the counsel's failure to object could not have impacted the trial. That opinion, that decision, that judgment is entitled to weight and can be disturbed only if manifestly erroneous, and I don't believe it is. Counsel explained that he did not object because he was afraid of not only of the judge's reaction, but how the jury would respond to any objection. And it is within matter of judgment for counsel not to object to a matter for fear that the objection itself would draw more attention to the matter than not objecting. So I submit that the trial counsel's handling of the court's remarks did not represent ineffective assistance of counsel, did not de re represent deficient representation. It was a reasonable on-the-spot decision by a attorney in the middle of the trial having to make a quick judgment, and I think it's one that a reasonable attorney could have made or would have made. And in fact, somebody else would or could have acted differently does not establish ineffectiveness. If there are no further questions, I will stand on my argument.
All right, thank you. Mr. Waller, rebuttal argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess to go through this chronologically, it's not just me that's saying that this is an important question in the case or that this is a crucial question in the case. Everybody on the Zoom right now, except for Mr. Manchin, has made this finding already. It was basically law of the case in the previous appeal. It said this was an important question in the case, whether Troy knew the police had been called, whether he left before the 911 call had been made. And I would, you know, the record stands speaks for itself. I would ask the court to watch that video because counsel has made several representations about the facts of the case that are simply not true. The police car lights were not on. The officer approaches from the other side through an alley from another set of residences from another street in the dark. He's got his thing activated, but you can't see much because it's dark and there are no police lights on. As he's walking up, Troy is saying, "You're going to jail. to Ms. Adams. So there's a maybe a rebuttal against consciousness of guilt right there. The officer walks up and turns his light on as Troy is walking towards him. He says, "Put your hands up." So Troy's got his hands up and walking towards the officer. You can say he was walking from where the gun was found. You can say he was walking from the vehicle. You can say he's walking from the back door of the house. It's hard to tell with the layout. But you can't just say he's walking from that vehicle and ignore the entire rest of the world that's standing behind Troy McKinney at that point. I mean, and while we're talking about the record and what it actually says, on remand, counsel did not testify about not subpoenaing the 911 call because he was worried there was a gun, mention of a gun on the recording or the tone of the voice. That is entirely invented by Mr. Manchin here for the oral argument. He never says anything about that. He only says that sometimes they say, I've had to call 15 times. Here I am speculating, but counsel doesn't say anything about the gun or tone of voice. It just that it has oftentimes prejudicial information, not anything specific about this case, but just in his experience, that they'll say, "Oh, yeah, he's beat me up 15 times before." He's worried that the jury might hear something like that, which he doesn't even know because he didn't even listen to the recording. And the fact that it was in law enforcement possession and not tendered in discovery on its own, frankly, should have flagged to any reasonable criminal defense attorney that maybe it's not inculpatory, maybe it's actually exculpatory. But I'll leave that aside. Counsel never said anything about being afraid to object because of how the jury would have interpreted that. Again, that's pure invention today. Counsel said it would not endear me to the court. I didn't think it would go well for my client. Didn't say anything about the jury's interpretation of that. That was not part of his consideration. It was purely fear and reticence of retribution from the court. So all of these benefits of the doubt counsel's trying to give come from him. They're not on the record. That's all I'll say about that. Counsel's interpretation, trying to speaking to Justice Leonard's point about whether that one comment, if nothing else, was wrong. Counsel's interpretation that because he called, he left because I called. I agree, Your Honor, that it would be an inference. I don't know if it's even a reasonable one, but it is an inference. That's the jury's job. But more than that, to buy counsel's reconstruction of that statement, you have to pick and choose answers that didn't go with the questions. You have to choose non-responsive answers and put them to another question to establish anything remotely like he left because I called the police. So there's no reasonable argument. There's no reasonable argument that comment was proper. There were many other comments that were not proper. Taking them all together, raise an unfair trial, particularly when the reasons they were not objected to are not good ones. That any zealous advocate, we're not called to provide reticent advocacy. We're called to provide zealous advocacy, and that didn't happen here. In fact, that's what the Constitution requires. So, for
Waller,
those
if I
reasons,
can, if I
please.
may, Mr. Waller,
Yes.
quickly, and I know you made a reference to the first issue you raised in your brief in light of People versus Wallace, and you made a statement along the lines, "Well, I preserve that argument," but I guess I want to clarify before we end today, are you conceding that People v. Wallace addresses the issues that you've raised, or are you somehow suggesting to this court that this case is distinguishable, or the facts of this case are distinguishable? Or are you conceding that it's dispositive of the issues you raised?
I will say that I have not come up with an argument that it is not dispositive of argument one, without saying that I concede argument one. Yes,
Thank you.
I don't have anything to the contrary. So, with that in mind, we ask for a new trial. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Waller. Thank you both. The case will be taken under advisement and the court will issue a written decision. The court stands in recess.